This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Jan Reynolds has had a life that many of us, or at least I, wish we could lead. She's a skier, a climber, a member of record-setting expeditions. For a time, she held the women's high-altitude skiing record. She was on the U.S. biathlon team. She's a triathlon champion. She's also an accomplished author and photographer, writing about her expeditions and exploits, as well as researching the people and cultures she's encountered on her journeys. And every now and then, she must find herself back home because she lives in Stowe, Vermont. She grew up in Middlebury and graduated from UVM, lighting off for parts unknown before she had even graduated. But Vermont has always managed to pull her back. Jan Reynolds joins us today to talk about her latest book and her life in adventure. What a pleasure to finally meet you.
Well, happy to be here, Jane. Thanks for having me.
At the beginning of the show, I described the ascent of a peak in the Tibetan Plateau where you unintentionally set the altitude skiing record for women. And I can't even imagine climbing a mountain like that, let alone then taking some skis, strapping them on, and going downhill with a 40-pound pack on my back. Can you describe that?
Well, I guess I'd say once you're up there, you're pretty glad you do have the skis if you are able to ski down, because it will get you down to a lower elevation much quicker. We did something when we set that record that goes against the grain in terms of mountaineering. We put our highest camp at about 20,000 feet. Now, the climbing wasn't that technical because we were skiing this peak. When we did the Everest Grand Circle, we did some climbing in the winter season on a peak called Pumori that was radical, much more difficult than anything you'd find on Everest. But at any rate, back to Mustagata, it wasn't that technical, but the rule of thumb, that high, as you get closer to what they call the death zone, for your body to accommodate and be able to do it, the rule of thumb is to go 1,000 feet a day. We went from 20,000 to 25,000 in one day. That was a huge effort. But the two men that I was climbing with, Ned Gillette and Galen Rowell, they had done the first ascent and descent of Mount McKinley in one day. They went up and down from base camp in one day. Never been done. I haven't heard if that record's been broken yet. I'd heard it had been attempted. So when you're working with those guys, it's going to be going rather quickly. So when you reach the summit after that kind of effort, really, the skis were a lifesaver. There would have been no way I could descend that 5,000 feet quick enough before it got dark and we got into trouble.
You also write, though, that you, talking about rules of thumb, your rule had been you had to reach the summit by 8 p.m. or you were heading down no matter what. And you reached the summit and it was 9 p.m.
And this is a problem. And the book that became very popular that's called Into Thin Air, written by John Krakauer, who wrote me a lovely blurb on the back of my book. So that means it's a good book because he's a great writer. At any rate, Into Thin Air. A lot of the problem there was people did not respect their turnaround time. That's the only time on a peak we went beyond it. But I think what I should say, when you hear 9 p.m., this was the odd thing about China. We are in far western China. We are on the border where Afghanistan, Pakistan, former Soviet Union, and China all come together at the head of a pin. And all of China runs on the same time. So it sounds so late, but it isn't really.
Right, you're on Beijing time.
We're on Beijing time, which is so far east. China's huge. But still, we didn't respect the initial. We went 1 hour over, but we did have light. We did have time. We were all able to ski well enough. So 9 was the very edge. It was conservative turnaround time. And I guess one other thing I'd say about our expeditions is that the books that become popular are about all these terrible tragedies, as sad as they are. And we always were successful. They never really make the news. So yes, we pushed our turnaround time, but we made it because of skis. We're Vermonters, skiers. Ned and I were Vermonters.
Yes, and Ned often said, didn't he, that your expeditions weren't very well known because you had such success that even though you were sponsored and you were writing about them, they weren't these headline-making expeditions because, thankfully,
we made
nobody
it.
Died.
Yay!
Describe, though, what it's like to ski down, because one of the things that I found interesting that you described is even you expected at that point, you know, you strap on your skis and you head down. But you at one point had to stop because you were going to pass out from lack of oxygen, because you were skiing down as if you'd ski down Stowe, and you can't do that at
25,000 feet. I have to admit, I was naive there. That's what took me by surprise, because you're excited, you're happy, you know, you've had your moment on the summit. But I think a lot of people know this now, that when you're on the summit, it's not as if you stay there very long. More people lose their lives on the way down. That's trickier, the descent. So we're getting ready to turn around, checking each other's bindings, make sure things are working properly. And you head off and you make those first few turns. We have been working aerobically on the way up. But what happened is, with those turns and that effort, you go anaerobic and you don't realize that. And all of a sudden, there's no air in your lungs and you stop. And it's as if you've been underwater for a long time. And then you, if you ever have, and you come up and you just take that big breath of air. I had to stop for a moment and breathe. And I said, okay, we got to ski a little differently here. I've got to like aerobically make my turns.
When you took that big breath of air, could you get enough?
I could get enough. So, you know, you're working at 50% of the oxygen that you get at sea level. So it's not just your muscles. You have to realize your brain is only getting 50% of that oxygen. So you really need to think things through with your partner. You're talking to each other to make sure you've got it together and it's all processing properly. You can't have a mistake in those situations.
What drew you to that kind of adventure?
I think a lot of it is just the physical life. I was always very physical. I made ski teams. I always trained because they were Nordic teams. And it was a way of life for me. And I love the outdoors. As I began to climb more and more, as I began teaching skiing. And then some of the other people that I taught with were guides out in Yosemite. So I began to climb and appreciate mountains. So putting those two things together, training, mountain skiing, you know, bigger, higher, faster, it was all compelling.
Did you have an idea that this was the kind of career that you were pushing yourself towards? I mean, you describe in the book getting out of college, going to Smugs and just saying, hey, can I get a job here? You know, can I do anything? Did you have a vision at that point?
I think it's important, especially for any kids or younger people reading my books or whatever. I didn't always know exactly what I was going to be. When I have to fill out a form, I write writer, photographer, author, lecturer. That's really what I am. These were just the places that I like to go to get my photograph, to get my story. And I did end up setting records. And I should say that when we climbed and skied Mustagata and I set the women's high altitude skiing record, I didn't even know I was setting a record. I didn't know there was even a record out there. We were actually working for National Geographic magazine. We were doing an article about the local people that were at the base of the peak and also the climb, because we were doing something that hadn't been done. We were let in that far west in China, which at that point, no one was let in that far. The reason we got in that far to cover the region was because we were going to climb and ski something. So really, my records and all that jazz, it was just a vehicle to be able to do my writing and my photography.
Really? So writing and photography was the vision from the start?
Well, I would say in high school, I had a short story published. I had a couple of photographs exhibited at Boston Center for the Arts. So those were the things that I liked. And I was able to do these expeditions because they were always looking for someone who could take photographs for the sponsors or who could write something up if it needed to be. And those were skills I had. So it was a broad skill set, but yes, professionally, when you look at it, I have about 20 books out now. I have several for kids, mostly for kids, three for adults. They're all nonfiction. So from my point of view, that's what I do, is write and photograph. But where I go is the perk, the benefit, the great part about it.
We're talking with Jan Reynolds. She is an adventurer and an author. Her latest book is called High Altitude Women. And listeners, if you have questions for her about what it's been like to have these adventures or to think about being a woman in a male-dominated field, which is part of the focus of High Altitude Women, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Jan, can you describe your relationship to your physical body? Because it's a part of obviously being a woman and a part of being an adventurer and doing these extremely physical activities. And I'm curious how you, what your relationship is to your physical body.
Well, I guess I should probably, you know, this being radio, you can't see me, but, you know, I'm now pushing 60. And I'd have to admit, I feel honored that I've had a body that can do the things I've asked of it, but it always gave me the hints that it was up for it. So, yes, we have our mind, we have our body, we have mind-body connection. But I guess I don't want to say I just saw it as a machine to carry my mind around, but it's something to be honored and taken care of. As you get older, you want to make sure you can keep doing the things that you love. So I guess I would say I have a very close relationship to my body. I appreciate it. It's done a lot for me. It also has come with its glitches. It's a genetic trait. It's in our family. We have arthritis. And I now have had 3 knee replacements. They put one in crooked, so they had to take it out and do it again. I've had major back surgery with a disc that exploded. I had major shoulder surgery, the rotator cuff, labrum. They've all been patched. I do everything. I ski. I do hot yoga. So I guess I look at my body in my close relationship to it as something I really need to care for and look after. And as you get older, you really need to look after it.
How do you think others have seen you? I mean, a lot of your expeditions, especially in the early years, were with men. And you talk about one point at which it's warm enough, even though you're skiing, that you can strip down and everybody's wearing their ski pants and suspenders. And you describe saying, fine, if the guys are doing it, I'm going to do it too. And those suspenders will hold up my breasts just fine. And I'm going to ski down. Do you think you saw yourself differently than they saw you? Or was the fact that you were able to just say, hey, I'm one of you, was that enough to dispel any kind of awkwardness?
I think to get you in the mood of an expedition, you know, you all just sort of become neuters and neutrals, and you are like little animals carrying your homes on your backs. Think of yourselves as turtles or whatever. And I see us as teammates. You know, we're a team. We live in tents. That was in New Zealand. We were stormed in for almost like a 2-week period, barely moving from one place to another. We were in a snow cave for several days. We were in a hut that's the size of a fishing shanty that could only fit in 2 bunks where you could just barely slide in to lay down on the bunks. I mean, so those things really kind of pale in the, when you're in life and death situations, it's nothing. It's nothing.
We got a question from a listener named Dennis who says, what examples of sexism have you experienced, or is it all good sportsmanship?
Well, I don't know if you would call it sexism. This is pretty fun. Thanks for coming in with that comment, because in my book, I take my anecdotal experiences as being the only woman on these expeditions, and then I back it up with social science, current social science and data. And I find it so interesting, because men and women are different. We are our hormones. Our hormones are chemicals in our brains. Our chemicals in our brains cause different responses. And so I guess I wouldn't say it was necessarily sexism. We tend to think of that as having negative connotations. It's more noticing the differences. For example, there was a test. There was a test given to men and women. The women, men and women were interviewed after the test. Every woman to a one underestimated. They were asked, what was your score? They underestimated what their score would be. Every man to a one overestimated what their score would be. So these are the things that I'm talking about. So we are going in. I am planning with a male, Ned Gillette. We were co-leaders of this expedition to climb and ski all the peaks around Everest. And we did it in the winter season, which was horrific. Never been done in the winter before. Jet stream winds lower onto the tops of the peaks. They can even be up to 500 miles an hour. So our first peak is Pumori, which is very radical, very steep, very technical, much harder than anything you'd see on Everest when you're climbing it, the route we're doing. And Ned says, okay, I think it's skiable. All right. So now I talked to you about the tests, the way men look at things, the way women look at things. And I'm going, looks good, but we can go to the ridge if we're going to circle Everest, and we could spend more time with the people. It could be more cultural. maybe I'm underestimating physical abilities, but just have a different view of how we can do the circle. Well, in the end, we took our skis in there. We took one look at Pumori, and the guys are going like, there's no way we're skiing that. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, duh, if you looked at the declination lines, it's obvious, you know. But it's not that I'm right or they're right. It's just a point of view. And I think what I'd love to get across in the book is that as a team, there is a place for women and men on all teams in all occupations. We see things differently. So we have something different to bring to the table. There were many times on the expedition where, when it was co-led by both a male and a female, Ned and I, that, for example, he would often handle politics and organization. This may sound like we picked it to be gender specific, but for our two personalities, it worked really quite well. I was happy that he handled the politics. The politics in Nepal can be crazy when you're getting permissions and whatnot. And I tended to handle the team and the equipment. And I always knew what was working, what wasn't working, what needed to be repaired, how everybody's feeling, what's going down. The guys, again, this may be sounding sexist. You did say sexism. It's a long answer to your question there. But this is true. It's been proven that women read facial expressions and body language better than men. So I could look at Ned and say, wow, you mean you didn't know that Jim had that huge blister on his foot? He can hardly work. I also handled the med kit. It looks like it could be infected. I don't know. Maybe we should do a shorter day today, a longer one tomorrow, and see how it's going. But would Jim ever talk to Ned about the blister on his foot? Probably not. Would Jim talk to me? Yeah, maybe. That's how I knew. So I just really would love to get people to understand that there, since we're talking specifically about expeditions and things that are physically hardcore, yes, there is a place for a woman there, and women are great at endurance events.
You talk in the book, though, that about Jim specifically. You say that he mentioned at one point, it's nice to have a woman along on the trip because she monitors things. And you tried to get at him to see what that meant, and he sort of just kept repeating that. But he was able to tell you things that he might not have told the other men on the trip. But then back on the New Zealand expedition, which was one of your earliest expeditions, you were with Ned, who was often a partner for you on these expeditions, and two other young men who you thought probably didn't want to rope up with you, for example, because you were a woman. So it wasn't always just differences. In some cases, you got the sense that it was because you were a young woman that people didn't think you could do things.
Well, I want to say a couple of things here first. Number one, Jane, you are awesome. You really read the books. You really know the stuff, and you're asking great things. You know, I'm really impressed that you got into it that way. And here's my analysis of that. On the expeditions, my limited experience, the older men tended to appreciate me once I'd sort of shown I could cut the mustard. And I found that younger guys tended to be less accepting. Now, I can't exactly tell you why, but both the guys in New Zealand were younger. They were about my age. Ned's a little older. And something else that I should say, I said there were two things. The other thing was that Ned and I lived together, and we were a couple. So with two rope teams, although we worked that way on the other expeditions, I think the other team started to feel like, well, I should be with Ned. And I learned on that expedition and all the other trips, we did shake up the rope teams all the time. So live and learn. I'm not sure if it was because the other two fellows were younger. I think the younger guys challenge me more or are less accepting. I've got to prove myself more than with the older guys. Maybe the older guys are more secure. Hard to say. But also changing rope teams, I think, was always critical and important.
We're talking today with Jan Reynolds. Her new book is called High Altitude Women, From Extreme Sports to Indigenous Cultures, Discovering the Power of the Feminine. Listeners, if you have questions for her or thoughts on that idea, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. We got a tweet from Jim who says, my favorite Jan Reynolds quote is, I am forever wondering if I'll measure up to my self-inflicted tasks. Jim says, that's on my door at work. So if you have a thought for Jan Reynolds, Reynolds or want to share your favorite quote, again, call 1-800-639-2211 or post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're hearing stories of adventure, intrigue, and danger today from Jan Reynolds, a record-setting skier and adventurer who's made a career of traveling, photography, and writing. When she's not in some far-flung mountains, she lives in Stowe. We're also talking about what it means to be a pioneering woman in a male-dominated field and how Jan Reynolds has navigated that tricky terrain over the years. Her latest book, High Altitude Women, explores those thoughts. And listeners, if you want to comment on that or if you have questions for Jan, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Ryan, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hi, Jen. It's an honor to talk to you. I was wondering... For someone like me who envies those, who climbs those big mountains and does extraordinary things like that, I was wondering where, how do you start, get into that?
Well, I think a great place, if you want to get started now, and it depends on where you live, but go to whatever is the closest sporting goods store that has that kind of, like here in Burlington, Outdoor Gear Exchange would have everything you need. And in those stores, whether you're at an EMS or whatever is near to you, the people that sell the gear tend to know what you need, where the good places to go and get started, and also guides to help you get going. I know, for example, right in Stowe, we have places that you can go and you can hire a guide for almost anything that you want to do. So I think it's the sporting goods store, the outdoor goods store is going to be, I don't know how basic you are. That's the place. That's where the people will be that really know their stuff, or they can put you in touch with the people that know their stuff. And then if you were asking me about doing something internationally, something big, something far flung, that's born right from that group of people that you've met that you're either kayaking with or you're rock climbing with. As you go up in levels, you just start meeting more and more people, and then you'll make your own game plan. I mean, you have to get permissions in places like Nepal to climb and ski, but they do have something that's called trekking peaks. You can go there and you can go to a trekking peak for free. There are books about the trekking peaks. You can go to libraries, bookstores, read about them. Or, you know, there are lots of countries. You can go to Central America. You can do some of the volcanoes. So it's really just homework and buddies. That's literally all we ever did was just brainstorm. What do we want to do next? Where do we want to go? Commit to it and then start putting the pieces together to get there. It's really, I think, how you take a dream into becoming a reality is making that commitment. You just say, that's where I'm going. And once you do, things start falling into place because you've made that commitment.
I was really amazed in reading to see and to think about how you knew things like being able to read the snow, to know when there's a risk of an avalanche. Because, you know, growing up in Vermont, that's not the kind of thing that you're going to encounter in skiing here. So even if technically you're a fantastic skier, how do you learn that stuff so that then when you're on an expedition, not only can you do the technical stuff, but you can make sure that you're being safe? Is that just buddies too?
Well, yes. And I have to admit, I love Vermont. I am a woodchuck. I am a Vermonter. But I was spending, when I was working for a lot of the ski magazines, writing and doing photography, I had a base in Vail, Colorado, and I took avalanche courses there. They're very specific courses and teachers that I wanted to spend time with. And I spent summers sometimes in Yosemite. I was on their rescue squad, so I could stay there, and I would train and climb there in the summer. So some of my skills came from Colorado and California that I couldn't get in Vermont so that I could take them to the Himalaya.
In addition to doing all of this kind of adventure sport writing, as you mentioned, you've written several books for children in the Vanishing Cultures series, and you've explored different cultures that you've experienced on all of these trips. Why did you want to write that kind of book for kids?
Well, it's sort of a a longer story that goes with that one, but I did mention my back earlier, and what happened was, and it's all part of a genetic arthritic condition, I wasn't able to walk for a couple of months while they were trying to see if something would abate, but it didn't. I ended up having surgery. But during that 2 months, it's almost as if this would be great for a lot of people to have this kind of, call it crisis if you want. A couple of my articles, I was working on one for Geographic and one for Smithsonian and one for Sports Illustrated. And never happened before. All three were killed at once. And at the same time, I was not able to walk. And I was hitting a point where I thought I could just keep my bag packed. I was doing enough work that I would get a call and I'd go out the door and I'd do my work as a freelance journalist. So the way I saw the world at that point, everything just crumbled, the body, the work. And so for 2 months, I could think about it. And I really thought, I said, what would I do if I could do anything I wanted now? If they put me back together, if I have surgery and I'm walking fine, what would I do? You know, what means the most to me? I had time to really give it some thought. And the people that I had met in all these nooks and crannies of the earth were so wonderful. I fell in love with them. They meant so much to me. And I said, well, if they put me back together, I've set some records. I really don't want to do that again. And if I was inspiration, well, that's enough. I've done that. Hopefully it's inspired people. I really, when it got right down to it, when I couldn't walk for a while, I was able to think of what was the most important thing to me, and it was doing something for that group of people. And the reason, which would be Indigenous people. And they took care of me. They were so good to me. They lived very differently. I wanted to capture what was there of these cultures before it was gone. Therefore, the series is called Vanishing Cultures. And even if you went now to where I was, you wouldn't see what I had. I caught so many of them right on the edge. So, for children, the reason I chose to switch, I already had a book out for adults. I switched to writing for children because adults are wonderful, but they tend to be locked into their job, their payments, their house, their mortgage. It's very difficult to make big changes. Yet, if I could take this material about Indigenous people and how they live connected to the land and the animals, so they are environmentally living sustainably, to get that thought across to all people, I felt it was more important to work with children, to get them to really grasp these concepts, to care about these concepts, and to fold them into their lives so that when they were adults, it could affect how they would vote, what they would buy, how they would treat other people, how they would treat animals. So I made that, I mean, I don't want everyone to have a crisis like that, but that's why I switched, like turning a dial to working with people for children, writing a series called Vanishing Cultures.
Well, and in fact, when you pitched the series, you couldn't sit down. So you were talking to editors, trying to get them to sign off on letting you go around on these amazing treks. And they would say, have a seat, and you couldn't do it.
No, a friend of mine, my back was still problematic, and a friend of mine drove me to New York City while I would lie flat in the car. So when I'd get in and pitch this to editors at publishing houses, they'd say, oh, have a seat, sit down. Oh, no, I've been sitting, you know, all, well, a little white lie. Oh, no, I drove here. I think that's what I had. I drove here. I'd rather stand. It feels much better. Thank you very much. And if those people knew they were going to give me money to go to all these places and I could not even sit down, do you think they would give me a contract?
No, probably not.
So now you really understand that when I say a lot of it is the commitment, I don't know if it's practical or if it's magical, but if you commit to something that this is going to happen and you then something I wish I could remember whatever it was. Maybe remember the quote from Goethe that begin it now. Beginnings have boldness, genius and magic in it. I don't have the quote exactly right, but probably a lot of you know what Goethe said. That applies to me. You make that commitment, And I was going to do those books, come hell or high water. And even if I couldn't sit down in front of an editor, and it's okay, I can say that now because the series has been out for decades.
Let's go to John calling in from Brandon. Hi, John.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
What about siblings?
Well, I knew exactly who it was when she said, John from Brandon. You made it through. Hi, honey.
How you doing?
I'm good.
Is this a sibling?
This is my oldest brother, John. So do you have a question?
Yes, I was going to put you on the line about siblings and if any of them were adventurous.
Well, I don't know. I think I'd let the siblings say that for themselves. I don't speak for anyone but me.
John, are you adventurous?
Am I?
Yeah.
I have been.
So what do you think of your sister?
Why, I think very much of her. She's amazing. We all do.
John, aww. I'm so glad you called. It's such a sweet thing to have your siblings call in. And now I'm not the only one on the program who has family members call in. So I appreciate that call, John. Jan, you've written this book, High Altitude Women. It's out. We've been talking a little bit about what's in it. But what do you hope to get out of writing a book like this that explores the feminine in all of this adventure?
Well, thank you for asking that, Jane. I guess, you know, we do our projects and we have something in mind. Does it ever reach the reader? It's like someone painting something. The painter has something in mind. Does it ever reach the viewer? But there are many things in there, but probably one of the most important things to me is I learned that, for example, there can be different things that can change the outcome in a woman doing something that she wants to do. If a woman is given clear and positive feedback, she will have exactly as much confidence as a man has and do as well or better a job. But for example, in the social science I talked about, there was a math test that was given. And in this study, when a man handed out the tests, the males scored higher than the females did. New set of people, same demographic. There was a female that handed out the tests, and she said really great things to all the women when they sat down. You've got this. This is great. Here's your test. I know you'll do well. The women scored as high as the men did. So when we know this as women, and when I know that, I just naturally love doing what the guys were doing. It wasn't what they were. I love doing certain things, and I love doing them at as high a level as I could. And it just happened to be guys that were doing that, so it didn't matter to me. But what I'd like to get across is that I want to be that voice in every little girl or woman's ear that says, "You've got this. You can do this. It's everything you have, everything you know is enough to make this happen. Go for it." I want to be that woman math teacher handing out that test.
Well, Jan Reynolds, thank you so much for sharing that thought and for sharing your stories with us on Vermont Edition today.
Well, it was such a pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Jan Reynolds' latest book is called High Altitude Woman, From Extreme Sports to Indigenous Cultures, Discovering the Power of the Feminine. We'll put a link at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Gone are the days of children of just about any age climbing into a car and just buckling up. Now, child car seats and booster seats are recommended for children all the way up to age 15 in some cases, which makes the recent recalls of two different brands of car seats of particular interest and concern to so many parents. Here to discuss those recalls and other safety issues for children in vehicles is Chris Bell. He's the director of EMS and injury prevention for the Vermont Department of Health. Chris Bell, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks very much for having me.
So these two recent recalls were huge. I think more than 5 million car seats were recalled by two brands, Evenflow and Graco. Why were they recalled?
Right. So in this case, both of them were actually because of a buckle. It's not really an issue with the seat itself or safety in a crash. It's an issue with the buckle. After time, as parents know, those buckles can get filled up with grime and dirt and
spit up
Cheetos and whatever else, right? The buckle itself can actually become more difficult to unlatch. And so in case of an emergency or you had to get the child out quickly, they wouldn't be able to do it. And so the seat itself is safe. Parents shouldn't stop using them. But the manufacturers issued a recall in both these cases, and they'll be sending out new buckles to parents and people who have registered that they have these seats.
So it is a safety issue? I mean, it sounds almost more like just an annoyance to have a sticky buckle from food.
Certainly an annoyance. And, you know, there could be those rare cases where it'd be important to get the child out of the car in a hurry after a crash or something like that. But I think both these cases, the seat itself can actually kind of unlatch and the whole seat can come out with child attached. And so
that's
that
right.
would be the option.
Yeah, I think often the booster seats are the ones that are harder to get a kid out in an emergency. Those infant seats you can lift and take out.
Carry them with you.
So we, and I should also say that we're going to put a link up to what models are affected so that parents can find out exactly which models, if it's their car seats. And you said that the deal here is that people can get a new buckle. So what do they have to do to get the new buckle?
Right. So the manufacturer will be sending new buckles to everybody who's registered. So, you know, I think we all get those little product registration forms when you buy a toaster or a television. But for car seats, it's pretty important to actually send those in. That's how the manufacturer is going to tell you that there's some kind of recall. These happen with some frequency. We get these. Every month we get from one manufacturer or another something that needs change and update. And so it's important to parents send those in. If you didn't send it in, you can check the manufacturer's website or the links that you're going to put up. And then just contact manufacturer if you have that model that's affected. And they'll send you at no charge the replacement parts and you can get those fixed in.
All right. So let's talk in a couple of minutes that we have about some of the other regulations and guidelines for kids in car seats. First of all, why do states have different guidelines? Why does Vermont have its own guidelines? Shouldn't it be consistent?
Well, you know, every state has some form of local government, and our best practices. Ours are pretty close to the national guidelines of best practices on what kids should do. And Vermont law says that everybody under 18 should be either in a child restraint or an appropriate safety belt. And for older kids, that means probably just the seatbelt on the car. And for younger kids, it means either a child restraint seat or a booster seat.
Well, and that booster seat, you know, from kids 8 to 15, in some cases, depending on height and weight, they might still need one. Are you really expecting 15-year-olds to be driving to high school in a booster seat?
So I'm the father of a 13-year-old girl who doesn't sit in a booster seat anymore. But, you know, she's also the right height and weight to be out of the booster seat so that the seatbelt in the car fits her properly. And so that's actually the upper limit. So once they're above eight, they need to be restrained in either a booster seat or whatever the right restraint is for that kid. And so most kids at, you know, a certain age, maybe up to 13, maybe a little younger, will fit properly in the regular seat restraint in the car, and that's just fine.
So what's the weight limit that we're looking at here?
You know, it's that doesn't come to me off the top of my head. I'll get that to you.
And I think it's if you're above 5 feet tall, then you probably are okay in a seat because your feet can, you know, your legs are hitting the seat, so you're sitting properly.
That and then the seatbelt, where it fits on your body and your shoulder. So I don't want to give you
listeners
the wrong number, but we'll make sure that it's definitely up on the website.
Good. And we'll put a link to that as well. Chris, what about rear-facing seats? Because there have been debates over the years, and it seems to keep expanding how long you're supposed to keep your infant in a rear-facing seat.
Right. As long as possible, really. Best recommendation is up to maybe age 2, keep them in a rear-facing seat. It just provides more structure if you're in a front-end crash, which is the majority of crashes people get into. And so more structure behind to protect the head and neck of the child or the infant. So in the back seat is always the safest. And then rear-facing seat, the law says under 1 and 20 pounds for sure, but up to age 2 is really a best practice.
You know, those car seats are not cheap, and you're supposed to have one that's within a certain time limit when you have a new child. Are there resources for parents who don't have the ability to buy those car seats?
There are. So Department of Health and the Vermont Governor's Highway Safety Program work together, and we provide free and low-cost car seats to families who are income eligible. And so on the website that you'll put a link to, bseatssmart.org, we actually have a list of all of our fitting stations where parents can go, and if they're income eligible, they can get a free seat actually get it installed in their car and installed the right way.
Yeah, and you mentioned those fitting stations, often at fire departments and such.
Yeah, EMS agencies, fire departments, hospitals, police departments, a number of different community organizations and agencies want to participate. We have over 100 car seat technicians in the state who are all volunteers, volunteer their time, take a 40-hour course to learn how to make sure every kind of seat is installed properly. And that's another big issue, too, is seats that aren't properly installed. We have a lot of seats that, you know, those are pretty detailed instructions, and every car seat is different. And so even if you try it yourself, you may want to run by one of the fitting stations and have a technician and make sure that it's in the right way.
Chris Bell is the director of EMS and injury prevention for the Vermont Department of Health. We have links to the car seat recalls and state car seat recommendations at vpr.net. Chris, thanks very much.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
Could you make a short film in just 48 hours? From frenzied shooting schedules to inevitable technical problems, it's an undertaking that's as stressful as it sounds. But for the past 4 years, teams of filmmakers have entered the 48-hour Film Slam competition in Montpelier to put their skills to the test. It's an event that's put on by the Green Mountain Film Festival. And this year, Vermont Edition's intern, Devin Karambalis, had the chance to follow the weekend competition from beginning to end.
What used to house the Black Door Restaurant on Main Street has been closed for some time, but tonight it's being used as the venue for the Film Slam competition's kickoff event. 9 teams of filmmakers from across New England await instructions.
Teams, welcome. My name is Professor Ben T. Matchstick. I live in Montpelier. I shall be your host for this weekend. Let's start off with your location. It is the corner of Elm and Court and School, commonly known as the Blinking Light.
The 48-hour Film Slam works like this. Teams are given a location, a prop, and a phrase of dialogue that they must use in their 7-minute films. The location, which you just heard, is a street corner in Montpelier. The prop is a Montpelier parking ticket, and this year's phrase is, "You'll have to go out the back." Filmmaker Matt Mazur says that in a contest where anything can happen, starting off with no plan is usually the best plan.
We kind of try to clear our heads of ideas beforehand and just try and be really open when we get there. There's usually a genre that we prefer and a genre that we'd really like to avoid. And we also usually hope the location's very close, because there's been a couple times where it's way out there.
Drew, spin the wheel!
Each team is randomly assigned a genre from a spinning wheel on stage that includes traditional styles, film noir, conspiracy, thriller, silent film, plus a few surprises.
Team Malone!
Feminine perspective mockumentary.
That's feminist perspective mockumentary. The following afternoon, a cold and cloudy Saturday, Evan Brown of Team E&E Productions is squeezing in some outdoor shots on Main Street before the snow squalls move in.
We pulled Buddy Movie. These two girls that just walked by us are the two buddies, the girlfriend and her boyfriend's best friend. So a buddy film.
By this point, the teams have been working for 20 hours, and they're running on fumes. Sleep deprivation is to be expected, especially if you're assigned the task of editing the final cut, like Brown's unlucky teammate, Ian Burnett.
I'll get a little bit more sleep than Ian. Ian will probably be up all night, maybe catch an hour here or there to finish editing it in time.
And time is, of course, the biggest motivator and the biggest source of problems. The editing process, which can take months for a feature film, is reduced to only a few hours. But somehow, by Sunday at 6 p.m., all cameras are off and the movies are ready to be screened. The Slam's MC, Ben Matchstick, tells the audience what's at stake.
We are almost ready to go. The first prize wins $1,005 in cash. Second prize is $500. Third prize is $250. And there is this year an honorable mention. So are you ready to have some fun tonight?
The short films are screened to a pack house filled with the teams, their friends and families, and people from Montpelier. Catching a glimpse of a familiar city landmark or local celebrity on camera is, after all, part of the appeal. Donald Ray is one of the three judges. He brought the 48-hour Film Slam to Montpelier 4 years ago. He says a good story can transcend even the tightest of time constraints.
It's a major challenge. It's a major achievement to even create a film in 48 hours, to even get something up on screen that works. But over and above that, the challenge is to make a story that works for the audience.
The night's big winner is Team Fondue Pneumonia Party. Yes, you heard that right. Their conspiracy film about the contest, titled Fade to Truth, took home the $1,000 grand prize. But even the non-winners feel a sense of accomplishment after a whirlwind project like this. Here's Chico Edward Eastridge from Team Malone.
It's completely exhausting. You generally don't get any sleep, and a lot of the time you are disappointed and heartbroken by various events that happen over the weekend. But in the end, it somehow turns out to be worth it.
At the end of the day, the Film Slam is much more than a competition. It's about creating something out of nothing with a group of friends and putting your chops to the test under some of the most unusual circumstances. For VPR News, I'm Devin Karambolis.
And that wraps up our program for today. Attorney General Bill Sorrell will be my guest tomorrow. Among the topics we'll discuss are the Vermont Yankee plant decommissioning plans and funding, GMO labeling legislation, patent trolling, and campaign finance. Send your questions or comments for Attorney General Sorrell to vermontedition@vpr.net. And then listen in tomorrow. I also want to remind you, Vermont Edition is on Facebook. You can find behind-the-scenes stuff on Facebook. You can continue the conversation about conversations that are happening now. This week, you can see all of the cakes that have been baked for Cake Week as we celebrate many Vermont Edition birthdays. But always, you will hear us here at noon and 7. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson and Devin Karambolis. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.